Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tovin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, and my co-host, as always, is Sun political reporter Andrew Doman.
Good morning, good morning.
Today, our guest is Clark County Commissioner Steve Sisolak. Thanks for joining us, Commissioner.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now you serve on the board that oversees Metro Police's budget, and there's been a lot of talk about funding for Metro. And coming up, there is a vote on the so-called more cops tax, a sales tax that would go to putting more police officers on the streets. But I know you've had some concerns about the proposal in the past. And what's your current thinking on what's coming before the commission?
Well, it'll come before the commission at the second meeting in November for a public hearing, which Commissioner Collins is bringing back a third ordinance as it relates to potential increasing the sales tax for more cops. And I've got the same questions that I've had for the first two ordinances, that I am not convinced by what the sheriff is showing us that there'll be one more police officer on the street as a result of increasing the sales tax. I think this is, it's a misnomer, the name. I think it's more money for cops, but it's not more cops.
Is there any way that what do you need to see kind of to convince you that this is a good thing?
The first thing I need to have someone explain to me, and I've asked the question repeatedly, there are approximately 2,400, 2,500 right now commissioned officers in Las Vegas, in Clark County. Their career span is about 20 to 25 years, depending, you know, how long they stay in and whatnot. So we're looking at just, conservatively speaking, attrition of about 80 officers per year. Well, the academy right now that we have running, I think, has 42, 44 people in it, which they hope to graduate somewhere in the high 30s out of that academy. It takes 18 months from the time you start the academy till you get an officer actually patrolling in a car by themselves on the street, 18 months. So if we're going to have 80 officers retire next year through attrition, you've got one academy going that's going to have 38 people graduate from it. Explain to me how many more officers you're going to have on the street with or without the sales tax increase.
Right, there's going to be a bit of a deficit there still.
And that's what's gotten us into this situation that we're in right now. For the last 5 years, the county and the city have funded Metro. We have funded positions that have gone unfilled because the sheriff was afraid to continue to recruit folks and run academies for a question about what his budget was going to be. So he built up this enormous surplus that he had, about $80 million 3 years ago, that was money that was for funded yet unfilled positions. Now if you run, and his argument is that you can start several academies, have several academies going at one time. And that was one of the problems we had 7-8 years ago when we ramped up more cops to begin with, that there was a real strong recruiting effort put out, and the quality of some of the candidates that you're getting isn't up to what it is when you're selecting only 50 to go through a class or 100 to go through a class. So I think this needs to be a gradual step upward. It can't just be done in one fell swoop in order to accommodate the necessity of more officers.
Right. And, you know, at the same time as this is going on, you've kind of been in headlines the past few weeks here with this issue of the arbitrator who was used in the deal between the police officers union and the county to come up with what amounts to a bit of a pay bump and a bit more health insurance benefits for police officers. Now you've said, okay, here this police the arbitration hasn't been done in a manner that's above board. Now there's opinions flying left and right about who filed paperwork correctly or incorrectly. What do you make of this at this point? Why does this matter?
Well, why it matters is, first off, that we went through an arbitration. We had extensive negotiations with the PPA that fell short. The contract was arbitrated, and between what was agreed upon and what was arbitrated out through the arbitrator's decision, it's about $11.5 or $12 million increase to the PPA contract.
And that's the Police Protective Association, the union representing police officers.
Correct. Now, there's two subsequent labor negotiations that are going to be dealt with. One is the PPACE, which is the civilian employees, and one is PMSA, which is a Managers and Supervisors Association, which managers and supervisors is usually pretty much a Me Too contract, that they'll get what the other one got. PPACE will be probably end up being arbitrated again. My concern is that, and I don't have a concern necessarily what finally was agreed upon, was the three-quarter, and the increase of the health. I think it was a big bump to the health all at one time, especially when we restored merit longevity at a cost of about almost $5 million a couple months earlier for the officers. My concern is that 288.215, which is a statute that covers arbitration for police officers, is written in statute It clearly delineates how the procedure is to operate. It didn't happen that way. And if it doesn't happen that way, somebody needs basically be put, in my opinion, on notice and say, hey, look, you guys are playing, which is my contention, fast and loose with the rules. You're not following what needs to be followed according to statute, and you need to do that.
So they're not following the law, that, and you just said they need to go back and do it again, basically?
No, I'm not saying they need to go back and do it again, because, quite frankly, the statute calls for, if the arbitrator reaches a decision, which happened, the arbitrator reached a decision, that law is binding, that decision is binding on both parties. And I'm not questioning that we got to undo that and go back and do it over again. But it is clear in reviewing the steps that were taken along the way here, they did not file, they did not follow 288. They just didn't do it.
What's the penalty for that? What happens in the end?
Well, that's a great point. There isn't a penalty. That's the problem. It says nothing in the statute what happens if you don't follow it. And what do we do when another group, whether it's in a small county somewhere, a small city, or somewhere else in the state, says, you know what, the PPA didn't have to follow the rules of Clark County. Why should we follow the rules?
So
why do we have to submit written arguments? I mean, they didn't have to do it.
So are you bringing this up now because you just don't want to see this happen again in the future? Is there really nothing you can do to wind back the decision?
I'm not attempting to unwind the decision. I'm not attempting to do that. I think that ship has already sailed, quite frankly. I do want to have both parties acknowledge that, hey, look, in hindsight, we probably didn't follow. We clearly didn't follow, you know, what the statute called for. There aren't written briefs that were filed at the end. There aren't written. This is $12 million of taxpayer money that's being spent. I think it's incumbent upon both parties, and the law is written that way for a reason, so that people can go back and look at it and say, okay, here's what the police offered, here's what Metro offered, you know, this is how the arbitrator came to the decision that he came to. You can't do that now. And I think it's only fair, because that's what the statute calls for, that someone that wants to look at this and examine the process would have access to those, that type of evidence and that decision, how it was rendered. That we can't do that anymore. And I think the parties need to acknowledge that, look, apparently we made some mistakes, and we're going to be extra vigilant to make sure it doesn't happen again.
So that's the best outcome that can come out of this, is people to say, oh, we made some mistakes. There's no penalty. There's no remedy going back. It's just a matter of sort of going forward. This might change.
Well, there is a statute to challenge an arbitrator's decision. The bar is very, very high to mm-hmm. challenge an arbitrator's decision. I don't intend to challenge the arbitrator's decision. Now, could some citizen or citizen group that has decided, hey, look, you know, they've gone too far, they've just shown a total disregard for the statute, I guess somebody could do that. And like Mark Ricciardi said on John Ralston's program two, 3 days ago, I guess it was, this would be a first impression of the court if someone were to challenge it. This is my opinion or my awareness. This has not happened before in talking to people. The statute has been followed. I've checked with the county staff, and we're involved in numerous arbitrations every year. It has never been done like this. And the concern is that if we start doing it now, then what do we have the statute for? So we need to say, hey, look, we made a mistake here. Let's make sure we don't do it again.
And speaking about how the public's tax money is spent, the other day you gave a talk, talking taxes, a few cents here and there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. And there's a gas tax increase, water rates are going up, a potential sales tax increase. Has anybody really looked at, you know, what does this all mean for in real money and how much that amounts to for the average family here in Southern Nevada?
Well, I think that they intentionally don't look at it, what it means for the average family. And I can tell you what really drove this home for me, and I appreciate, you know, you bringing it up. My mom's going to be 87 years old tomorrow. And I spoke to a senior group a month or 2 months back, I guess. And they hit me with the idea and asked me how much a pound of apples costs. And I don't know if you gentlemen know how much a pound of apples costs. I didn't know. I really didn't.
You got me there.
My daughter does her shopping, and she says, well, it used to be 59 cents. It went up to 89 cents. She goes, and it's 10 cents on a gallon of gas. Apples went up 30 cents a pound. Now you want to increase my sales tax. The water rates are going up. And my Social Security went up 1.5%. She goes, it used to be that I could get till the end of the month with my Social Security. Then it was fine in a month that had 30 days, but in a month that had 31 days, I didn't have quite enough money. So I just had to eat what was left over. She tells me in a month that the people at the Nevada Seniors Coalition are telling me that they now do their grocery shopping at the dollar store. Instead of going to Vons or Albertsons or Smith's, they go to the dollar store so they can buy whatever is 99 cents or a buck, because that's all the money that they have. And these little taxes that we say, well, it's just a few cents here, or it's only 15 cents here, and, you know, 10 cents here, to the folks that are on such a fixed income, it's an awful lot. And those are the people that can least afford to pay. And I think a sales tax is extremely regressive. While they don't use a lot of gas, they do say that, hey, look, still when I fill up my tank, even if I fill it up once a month, it's still going to cost me, when it's 10 cents a gallon, you know, an extra, you know, $2-3 a month. And to these folks, it's a lot of money. And I understand that it's not the one tax. It's not the 10 cents on the gas or the 0.15 on the sales tax or the $3 for the water. It's a cumulative effect of all of these things when they factor in groceries and when they factor in prescription costs and medical care and they factor in their electric bill and their, you know, Southwest gas bill and whatnot. And people that are on a very, very fixed income, it's really, really tough for them to make ends meet. And I think we need to be much more aware of that and cognizant of that. I know I argued the same point when I spent 10 years on the Board of Regents, and your guys at your age can understand this a little better. I made a point that said, hey, look, because what we would do is one month we talk about tuition, the next meeting we talked about Reuben Board, the next meeting was about technology fees, and the next meeting was about parking fees, and the next meeting was about student health fees. I said, look, let's do this all at one time. It's just because it's the cumulative effect of all of these things that a student is faced with. And it's not fair when you do it piecemeal and they don't see the overall impact of the thing. So I lobbied and we did start lumping those together and having a meeting that was dedicated to fees and raises.
You've got the, at the state level, the state's labor economist basically saying here, one of the troubling things in this state is wages have kind of stagnated. You know, they're not keeping pace with the growth of wages in other states, and certainly not with inflation. So we got to face the fact eventually that people in Nevada, while the recession is over, they're just poorer than they were. But at the same time, we've got these projects going forward with the third straw in Lake Mead, a lot of road building. How do you square that up, those two things, where you've got a lot of people whose wages don't buy them as much as they used to, and on the other hand, this economic development priorities that a lot of people think need to move forward?
Well, I'm very much in favor of the diversity and the economic development, diversification of our common economic development opportunities and the jobs. The problem you get with some of these jobs, it's like I did the big solar project we're talking about down towards State Line, and they provide some construction jobs for a very short period of time, but there's no permanent ongoing jobs. I mean, same as with the road construction. It's great. We're going to spend, I think it's like close to $700 million, I think, from this fuel tax, and it provided, I think, in their area of 4,500 to 5,500 full-time year equivalent jobs. Well, those jobs are going to be gone in 3 years. They'll all be over with. But we'll be continuing to pay for the next 20 years, 10 cents a gallon on the gasoline in order to have paid for those jobs and pay for that road construction. I am interested in trying to find something in a methodology where we can create permanent jobs, you know, manufacturing jobs, distribution jobs, those sort of jobs where they'll be ongoing. They won't be temporary and short term, because we've seen what's happened with that. When the economy slows and construction ends, all those guys and gals are unemployed, and that just adds to the problem that we have.
All right. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV. This is Neon Eden. Our guest this morning is Clark County Commissioner Steve Sisolak. And Commissioner, you know, in your opinion, are we getting what we should from Carson City when it comes to transportation dollars? Governor Sandoval said next year Clark County should be getting more, but the county is still on the hook for the Boulder City Bypass and Project Neon, right?
Right. I don't think we're getting anywhere near what we should. And I don't think I brought this argument up 15 years ago, like as soon as on the Board of Regents, or 12 years ago, that we weren't getting our fair share in terms of higher education. UNLV is funded at a lower level than UNR is. The College of Southern Nevada is funded at a lower level than GBC. GBC was getting almost what UNLV was getting, Great Basin College. The community colleges down here are not getting what they are up north. I think that funding disparity has existed long term. It's not just in highways, but we're currently not getting it highways. And you can make the numbers go a million different ways. And I've had it explained to me that the roads need more maintenance up there because of the snow and all the various different things that come in. But I don't think we get our fair share of money when it comes to education, when it comes to roads, when it comes to health care, when it comes to mental health care, when it comes to a variety of issues. I think the economic engine of Nevada is Southern Nevada, and it's generating a lot of money for the state, and it just does not get enough attention. And I'm glad that at least this fuel tax issue has raised the profile of the issue, and the governor has acknowledged it by potentially some funding increases coming south next year.
But it's still not enough. I mean, the governor's up there. He's up there in Carson City. He sits on the transportation board. has a big say in where this money goes. And he's saying next year, okay, you guys down in Southern Nevada are getting a little bit more, but it's still, in your eyes, not enough?
It's not enough. It's absolutely not enough, and it's got to. We're going to have to do something. Like I say, for decades, it's been that the disproportionate share has gone north, as opposed to coming south. And I'm not saying that there doesn't have to be some subsidizing, because there clearly does to the rurals. But I don't think there should have to be to Washoe. I mean, the fuel tax. Every county hasn't even implemented what's allowable in terms of the 9 cents that they can have for their own county fuel tax, yet we're using state money to subsidize them when they're not taxing their own gasoline. I've got a gas station in Laughlin that's in my district that the convenience store that they're telling me they're going to close now because everybody can drive across the bridge and get gas for 30 cents a gallon cheaper. So, you know, it can end up costing jobs in some extent as well. So I think we need to do a better job in terms of communicating the needs and getting our legislators to stick together and bring the funding where it should be, which, in my opinion, needs to be spent in Southern Nevada.
And here's another thing, too, with these sort of Southern Nevada issues. There's been some chat about a medical school in Southern Nevada, possibly through UNLV, and I hear there's going to be a study forthcoming about that. But what should kind of be done about that, in your opinion?
Well, and I've, like I say, spent some time on that and pretty familiar with the issues. If you were to do it over again, quite frankly, the law school would probably be by the state capitol and Supreme Court in Northern Nevada, and medical school would be by the population base in Southern Nevada, which would be UNLV, but it's not that way. I don't know if the state can support two medical schools. I would clearly like to see one in Southern Nevada. I think that the need is clearly here. I think the state has to make education a priority, and they have not done that as it stands currently. And unless we can get some private funding, I know that we have Toro is here, which is, you know, private school, and they've explored some options of expanding their campuses. But at some point, clearly, Las Vegas, Clark County will need a medical school. But in order to establish a medical school and to move forward, there has to be a commitment of funding. And I'm just not seeing that coming out of the state legislature either.
So does that, in your opinion, need to be an expansion of the UNR medical school, a UNLV medical school, a separate one? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that eventually it's going to have to be a separate one because there is still and the rivalry is a good thing, but it's a better thing when it's on the football field or the basketball court when it comes between the two universities. But the partnership of UNR expanding the medical school and UNLV's area is going to be difficult. And I really don't know. One of the problems, I don't think that it got the attention it clearly had when you had all the residencies down here and the clinical practices or UMC, and that's where we're sending people for their internships and residencies when you're operating from 800 miles away. You know, there's a big distance there, and the proximity to UNLV is, I think, a much better fit than the distance that exists between UMC and UNR versus UNLV.
And now, Commissioner, I think it's fair to say that, especially our listening public, we're the university radio station. Probably not as many university students, and not as much of the public as should get out to commission meetings. And so, in your opinion, what's the most exciting thing going on in the county right now, and what are the most pressing issues that the people should be paying attention to?
Well, we've got a couple big ones that are coming up in the next month before the end of the year. Let me say this: we're going to deal with the sales tax increase again. You're going to be hearing about that second meeting in November. We're going to be hearing the water rate increase in November as well, regarding, you know, whether or not the water rates are going to go up, and I think they're going to have to. We're going to be voting on single stream recycling, which is the process whereby you can put all your recyclables into one container and have them picked up, which is, there's pilot programs all over the county that are currently doing it, but it's not countywide, and this would make it countywide. Those are the biggest issues that we're going to be facing between now and the end of the year.
What's your take on the recycling? Should that be pretty easy to do, to implement, to just put it all
in
one bin?
That, frankly, it's not easy. That was a very controversial issue because currently we have, you know, you get your trash picked up twice a week and you get your recycling picked up once every other week is how it works. And under the new proposal, what they have done in some jurisdictions is they pick up all your trash once a week and all your recycling once a week. But you only get once a week pickup on your trash instead of twice a week. And people are complaining that, hey, look, you know, you're reducing my services, but you're keeping the cost that I had to pay the same. And they feel that the cost should have come down or they should pick up more often in terms of trash. They can't do that, is what they're claiming, with the capital investment and labor costs associated with having to send trucks out to pick up the recyclables. you know, I can speak for my, and I've got people on both sides of this issue, people that, quite frankly, my experience has been, and not to generalize, but I'm going to do it a little bit here, people that are a little younger are in favor and more receptive to the idea of once-a-week trash and recyclables, I think because they're more aware of the environment, maybe than middle-aged folks, and people that are senior citizens seem to be much more aware of the environment than folks that are a little younger. So you've got the real young people and people that are what I would classify as seniors more in favor of the single stream, and you get a lot of folks in the middle that are saying, wait a minute, I'm paying for something I'm not getting. There'll be reductions, so I want a rate decrease. We've tried to weigh that all together, and Republic Services have tried to accommodate a lot of the concerns that were brought forward regarding the size of these containers and special pickups and whatnot. So hopefully we'll be able to find a common ground, but this has been the last holdout, so to speak, in terms of the county. Henderson has pretty much implemented it, as has a lot of North Las Vegas and the city of Las Vegas.
Now, I want to switch gears a little bit here, and I know you've done some polling on this, and certainly it's been talked about a good deal at this point, but you know, it's sort of mulling a bid for governor as the Democrat to take on a Republican governor, Brian Sandoval, as he runs for re-election. And, you know, the governor is widely regarded as being a pretty popular guy, but is Governor Sandoval invincible at the polls?
Absolutely not. He's not invincible. I mean, we've done several focus groups, and our research has shown that he's – the term that's used about the governor is likable, that he's a likable guy as opposed to people necessarily agreeing with his job performance or some of his stances on various issues. So I wouldn't say he's – he clearly is not invincible, and we'll have to wait and see. I mean, not a day goes by that somebody doesn't stop me, whether it's at a grocery store or in the hallway or in the parking lot or wherever, and ask me the same question. So we're just taking our time.
When do you decide to run, though?
Well, I'm not on a timeline. There's not another Democrat stepping forward, you know, wanting to challenge the governor. If they do, I, you know, obviously my timeline would be different. Right now, I'm spending an awful lot of time. We're dealing with the fuel tax we just dealt with. Now we've got the sales tax. We've got the water rate increases. So I'm pretty busy here in Clark County while a lot of people are out campaigning and doing those sort of things, raising money. I'm focusing on right now on doing my job that I was elected to do.
So where's the governor vulnerable, though? I mean, you've done a bit of these focus groups. Where do you see him as maybe having a few weaknesses?
Well, we've got several areas that appear that people brought up. One is in the area of background checks on gun sales. One is in the area of education funding. Mental health resources dedicated to mental health is another area. Those are just a few of the several that we've come up with through our focus groups that people have brought to our attention.
And what do you think would be appropriate in terms of changes to state law in terms of gun sales, background checks, what people would need to do to sell a gun either privately or in a shop?
Well, I think that something needs to be done in terms of some type of a background check that, you know, we've got people that are convicted felons or have mental health issues that are capable of buying firearms at a gun show or a private sale, and that's a problem. I think that a reasonable person would believe that some sort of background check that is not too invasive, that is not too onerous, is, in my opinion, reasonable. I don't want to do anything to infringe on someone's Second Amendment rights, yet at the same time, we've got to protect society as a whole and make sure that people that are purchasing guns are responsible and capable of handling them.
Well, what do you think, though, about an assault weapons ban?
Well, assault weapons, I see no purpose for anyone to have to own an assault weapon. I don't believe that people necessarily really collect machine guns and assault weapons. I think that's kind of a stretch. I think some people want to own them simply because they can. You don't use an assault weapon to go duck hunting or deer hunting. So I don't think there's a need. It's not really an issue of protection. I just don't think that there's a need for people to own assault weapons.
So a ban like that is something you'd be in favor of?
I would.
And, you know, one of the things that I watched this background check debate go back and forth at the legislature, and a lot of people said, oh, you know, this will lead to a de facto gun registry. And it dawned on me, well, here in Clark County, we have somewhat of a firearms registry already, don't we?
We do. Through Metro, a lot of people have complained about that it's not effective. The police officers are very, very strong proponents of that because when they go out on call, and I did question that when that came to my attention, and you know they want to know if they're going out on a call, whether it's a DV case or a just a regular call into a home, and if there's a potential, a higher potential propensity for firearms to be there. And that's something that I think is reasonable for officer safety when you're talking about those kind of issues.
And one issue that came up in the legislature this year was taxing and our tax structure in Nevada, and of course the margins tax was a big issue that was debated. And what are your thoughts on the margins tax?
I'm undecided on the margins tax. You know, I've talked to several proponents of the margins tax that have tried to explain it to me. I pride myself on doing my homework and doing my reading and trying to being able to study issues. It is hard to get your hands around, in my opinion, the margins tax right now. I need to know better how it's going to affect everyday businesses. I've got a problem in so much as it's going to tax people potentially, I'm being told, or it's explained to me by the opponents of it, that are operating a business at a loss and would still have to pay a tax as a result of that on the margin, which would be a problem for me. There is something we need to do to capture some revenue from those corporations that are coming in and businesses that are coming into Clark County from out of state, taking the money out of here, using our services but not contributing. And I think we need to do that. I don't know if the margin tax is the best way to do it, if a gross profits tax would be a better way, or if there's another way to capture some of that revenue. And I'm not an expert in taxation policy by any stretch of the imagination, and I haven't been involved in that debate because that's not something that we do at the commission level. So I'm waiting to hear the debate as it comes forward next year on the margin tax.
And I know you've been a proponent of a sales tax on services before to bring in some of those businesses that maybe aren't really getting taxed and at least have them pay something into the state. If you do decide to run for governor, though, is this something that you expect will be a big part of the debate between you and Governor Sandoval?
Well, that's a big if, and we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But, I mean, we clearly have a difference of opinion. I think our economy has changed a lot in terms of taxes, what we are rendering here. I mean, it's a sad situation, in my opinion, when you go buy your child a new notebook for school and you have to pay sales tax on it, but if you go get a facial and a massage, you don't have to pay sales tax on it. So I think things are a little mixed up there. There's so many exemptions in the sales tax category that they've had to go to double letters for people that have strong lobbies and get things removed from the sales tax list. I think that's something clearly we need to look at. I think the rate could be reduced and the base expanded. I don't see a problem, but you're going to get a lot of lawyers and so forth arguing against that and lobbyists because obviously they might be subject to it.
You mentioned you and Governor Sandoval differ there in that regard. What are the biggest differences between you and Brian Sandoval?
Well, I don't know all the differences. I can tell you what some of the ones that I see. I'm a firm believer in education. I just, like I said, having spent 10 years on the Board of Regents, I believe that, you know, we need to do what we can. Education is a great equalizer, in my opinion. I think that there needs to be give and take on both sides of this issue. Throwing money at the education isn't of in itself going to solve the situation. Yet at the same time, there needs to be an accountability of the money that's sent there. And we need to do something that we are not on the bottom of every good list and on the top of every bad list. And you can see, keep saying, things are great, things are terrific. I'm living in, you know, everything the pundits are calling them Sunnyville, but things aren't so great for the everyday family. Families are struggling. Unemployment is still at the high. I mean, our citizens are dealing with foreclosures, and I just don't think it's getting enough attention.
Well, it'll be interesting how the election shapes up next year. That's all the time we have for this show. Our guest today is Clark County Commissioner Steve Sisolak. Thanks for joining us, Commissioner.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tobin LePan. My co-host is Andrew Doman. Our producer is Richard Riegel. We'll see you next week.